Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings towards your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings towards your family's ultimate vacation. Even five times the savings towards just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One and a member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 2nd of November, these are our main stories. The White House raises hopes of a deal to end the US-China trade war. Boris Johnson defends calling a general election in the UK. In Algeria, demonstrators on the streets calling for a revolution. Also in this podcast, the outcry over a Chinese school using head rings to monitor pupils. And later,
how can you enhance those slow waves, the deep sleep, which would then lead to more slow waves and more clearance of waste products?
A new insight into how sleep helps clean your brain. For months, the US and China have been locked in a trade war, pitting two of the world's most powerful economies against each other. But both sides have now said they're close to finalising a partial trade deal. Addressing reporters on the lawn of the White House, Donald Trump's top economic adviser, Larry Kudlow, sounded hopeful.
The deal is not completed, but we've made enormous progress. We're beyond where we were last spring, so I'm going to play that from the optimistic side.
Our correspondent Samira Hussein is in New York. What have the two sides said about the potential deal?
If you look at the language that was being used by the Chinese news agency, the state news agency, they said that, look, we've actually come to a consensus. So when you're talking about these kinds of multilateral trade deals, the language that's being employed by both sides becomes really important. So on the one hand, you have the Chinese that are saying we have consensus. And on the other hand, you see that the Americans aren't going that far, but they are saying that there is progress. So that, of course, is good. Remember, this is been a trade war that has gone on for more than 15 months and is now having a significant economic impact right around the world, from China to Europe, and even now in the United States, you're seeing an impact. So it's really important to see a trade deal between the two sides inked, whether or not some of the most thorny issues have been resolved is still not totally clear.
Samira Hussein in New York. The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson knows that he is not certain to win the general election that will take place in just under 6 weeks' time. Not everyone thinks it was a good idea to ask Parliament to give him one. And now, a number of experts think the job of winning that election just got harder. The hardline Brexit Party has called on Mr Johnson to dump his hard-won EU withdrawal agreement, or they'll put up candidates against his party in every parliamentary seat in England, Scotland and Wales. So, does he accept this election is a gamble?
We've just got no choice. We've just got no choice. And Parliament is determined. This is a Parliament that is basically full of MPs who voted Remain, and the overwhelming bulk of the MPs in Parliament voted Remain. I love them. They're a lot of my friends, but that's the way they are. They voted Remain, and they will continue to block Brexit if they're given a chance.
I asked our UK political correspondent Rob Watson to explain how Nigel Farage's Brexit Party can spoil Boris Johnson's.
What will help Mr Johnson to win this election and the Conservatives is if pretty much all of the Leave vote from 2016, all 17.4 million, or well, most of them, swing behind the Conservatives rather than the Leave vote being split. And so the prospect of the Brexit Party standing against the Conservatives in every seat raises that very prospect. I mean, I should add this little sort of note of caution, perhaps on the side of Mr Johnson, just how effective and professional the Brexit Party could be in a general election, a nationwide election, is another matter. But I suspect that people around Mr. Johnson are rather nervous. Interestingly, I mean, Mr. Farage's position is quite typical of a lot of Brexiteers who, if you told them 3 or 4 years ago you could have a referendum and then Britain would leave the European Union, but maybe stay close to Europe, be like Norway or Switzerland, they would have said, yeah, great, fantastic. But one of the interesting things about the Brexit process in Britain in these 3 years since the referendum is everybody's position has got harder. Brexiteers want the hardest of hard Brexits, and Remainers, who many of whom had been willing to accept the result in 2016, are saying to themselves, this is nuts, let's fight it.
Yesterday there was an extraordinary radio show that Nigel Farage does on a radio station in London. Donald Trump phoned in and suggested that Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson should combine their forces and campaign for Brexit together. I take it no real chance of that happening.
That is what Mr. Farage has suggested, and my goodness, was it an extraordinary moment where Donald Trump said that he thought that Mr. Corbyn would take the country in a very bad place. He rubbished Mr. Johnson's deal to leave the European Union. I mean, it was extraordinary stuff. But yes, no, he proposed this pact. I mean, I just don't think that's very likely for the following reason, that the Conservatives have made a sort of a shift to the right. I mean, they've become much more like the Brexit Party themselves, and I think they're thinking to themselves, why on earth should we do a deal with Mr. Farage?
Our UK political correspondent, Rob Watson. Friday marked the 65th anniversary of the start of Algeria's war of independence against France. But instead of celebrating, thousands of demonstrators again took to the streets. I asked our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, why the protests were still ongoing.
They've ebbed and flowed. I mean, today was one of the largest for some time. There have been times when it's been far fewer people on the streets. But they have kept going, and their aim is not to be, in, as far as they're concerned, fobbed off with just a few cosmetic changes, what they want. And we're seeing this in other countries across the region and across the world. What they want is a complete change, a transformation of the system, which is why they were talking about a new revolution today. And they feel that that is still a possibility. What the government has offered are presidential elections next month, which you would think perhaps people on the streets would want, but they don't think that the political situation in Algeria at the moment is in any way conducive to having elections which would be free, which would be fair.
What have Algeria's current rulers made of this?
Well, they have made moves. I mean, a lot of the people, I mean, remember that the president, the veteran president, was his bid, or the people around him, I would have to say, rather than him, Abdelaziz Bouteflika. He was going to stand for a fifth term, a man who many people saw as a kind of living corpse who was still in charge of a country. So the movement was spurred by the idea that we can't have this continue any longer. So he actually stood down within a month or so of the protests happening. Since then, a lot of the people around him have also been removed. Many of them actually now being charged with corruption. But as I was saying, this isn't enough for the protesters. We've seen the army essentially take charge. This has happened again in many other Arab countries. In Egypt, it happened. And they're sort of steering the course now. They're saying, you know, that we can handle this and that the demonstrators have had their time and the country needs to return to stability. But that's not what the protesters are accepting.
Sebastian Usher. Joint military patrols by Russian and Turkish troops began on Friday on sections of the Syrian-Turkish border. It's part of the agreement that saw Kurdish forces given a deadline for pulling out of a strip along the border 30 kilometres deep. The deal is meant to end Turkey's military incursion into northeast Syria against Kurdish fighters, whom it regards as terrorists. So what's actually been happening on the ground? Our Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman reports from the border.
A group of children is cooking soup over an outdoor fire. In the Syrian city of Hasaka, thousands of Kurds have sought refuge. They fled as Turkish troops advanced 3 weeks ago. This is Serene Ibrahim, who's been helping turn the city's schools into camps for the displaced.
The situation in the villages they came from is not good. There are ISIS and Turkish-backed sleeper cells around. That's why the Kurdish people here will not be able to go back, even if the regime is now in their villages, because there are these people linked to Turkey there.
A shell is fired at Russian security forces patrolling the border. There was fighting this week, despite the ceasefire pact between Presidents Putin and Erdogan. Their deal involved Russia overseeing the withdrawal of Kurdish YPG fighters, whose hopes for statehood Turkey sees as an existential threat. We'd driven along the border road on the Turkish side. I watched troop carriers taking Turkish soldiers into northern Syria. President Trump's pullout and Turkey's offensive have redrawn the map of control in Syria. Where Kurdish flags once flew and Americans patrolled, the regime is back. The border is now carved up between the Syrian government, its Russian backers, and Turkey.
Well, here at the border, a busload of men have just shown up. They've got out. They're wearing combat fatigues and jumpers. This is a group of ultra-nationalists who are now holding up a huge Turkish flag. On the front of their bus, it says, "Tell Israel and America that Mohammed's army are back."
I met Mohammed Mustafa selling cable TV boxes in this Turkish border town. His shop narrowly escaped mortar fire from Kurdish positions in the first days of the offensive.
The Turkish nation is a fighter nation. We are trying to get rid of the baby killers on the other side of the border. Of course, I believe it, because our leader is Recep Tayyip Erdogan. We believe him. We believe in our state.
You're sitting in the dark.
But if you want, just like have a seat. Candle for you and for the romantic moment.
In the Turkish town of Şanlıurfa, further north, there's a power cut in this tour guide's office. He doesn't want to give me his name. He is a Turkish Kurd. He says even if his people built a settlement on Mars, President Erdogan would oppose it. Now he feels President Trump has cut them loose.
What did you think when al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, was killed?
I'm very happy. But the Kurds lost a lot of young people, young soldiers against ISIS. The operation against ISIS in Raqqa. And this ISIS attacked in Europe, in America, in any place. The Trump, when he said this, like, I'm going away, the Kurds felt cheated.
Even the children get to practice the call to prayer here. This is President Erdogan's heartland. He's a champion for Muslims and an icon for Turkish nationalism. And so here he appeals to heaven and earth. Shops even sell plates with his face on them in the town. But his pledge to crush Kurdish militants in northern Syria has aggravated old wounds within Turkey, and his Syrian border deal with Moscow is holding for now.
Tom Bateman on the Syria-Turkey border. Still to come in this podcast, you may know him best as an actor, but Jeff Goldblum is a pretty mean jazz musician. There are calls in Spain for changes to the laws on sexual offences. It comes after five men accused of the gang rape of a 14-year-old girl were acquitted because she was unconscious and so could not resist. Their defence was that the men hadn't used intimidation or violence. Lara Alcazar is a feminist activist.
Now the debate is about consent and about the fact that we have to stop saying no means no, and we have to start thinking about only yes means yes.
One journalist in Barcelona who's been following the story is Sarah Canals, referring to a former incident called the Wolfpack case. She told me this isn't the first of its kind in Spain.
The Wolfpack case in Pamplona saw five men convicted for sexually abusing a young woman. It was a similar case. And after a series of protests, the Supreme Court later converted the original verdict to rape and raised the prison sentences from 9 to 15 years. But we've seen a very similar scenario with the Manresa case. And this has led to many reactions and many outrages that claim again a change in the Spanish law, in the criminal code.
And there's been quite a reaction, hasn't there, both on social media and with people taking to the streets?
Exactly. On the one hand, we've seen hundreds of people that took the streets in Manresa yesterday night, and some activists are calling for another protest against the court decision in Manresa tomorrow by 1 p.m. local time. We've also seen some reactions on social media, even coming from some politicians. For instance, Barcelona Mayor Ada Colau, she has denounced the verdict and has considered it as outrageous. But mostly, we've seen a lot of women's rights groups speaking up, such as, for instance, an organization on female judges. They have demanded changes again to the Spanish law to define rape as sex without consent. They believe that the verdict reflects an outdated criminal code, and they want to change the law so that it's understood that only a yes means yes, and that consent must be given in a free, conscious, and responsible manner.
How can it be possible that this kind of attack can happen, that five men can rape an unconscious teenage girl, and for it not to be regarded by the law as rape?
This is the question that a lot of sectors from the society are asking. And in fact, the government and other parties promised to renew efforts to fight sexual violence after the Wolf Pack case in Pamplona. But as for now, no progress has been made. So it's kind of a standby scenario. The Socialist Party in Spain are claiming that some changes will be considered. But as for now, no progress has been made.
Journalist in Barcelona, Sarah Canals. To China now, where a school has been banned from forcing pupils to wear controversial head rings that monitor their behaviour in the classroom. The black gadgets look like something from a sci-fi film and apparently have no obvious side effects on the pupils who are wearing them. Our China media analyst Kerry Allen explains what they look like.
They're about an inch thick and they slip just over your ears with a little signal at the front, which is like a traffic light code. And they go green if your attention's really high and slip down to red if your attention's really low. And each one's got a number, so it's almost like a tracking device. And there's been this video footage that's been going viral in China, which shows a full primary school classroom wearing these rings. And obviously it's caused quite a stir online.
Yeah, do we know how they work?
Yes, the company behind them is a Massachusetts-based company, and they said that they're meant to help focus. They're meant to help children focus, but there have been concerns since that they might actually be able to track your brainwaves. Some of the footage that we've seen, they show just very, very detailed information, lines going up and down. So, yeah, people are very concerned about this.
Yeah, even though they've seen a video of a classroom full of calm children, there's been a backlash.
Yes, there has, yes. People have seen stuff like this in China before. Earlier this year, there was a case of a school that had introduced smart uniforms that could monitor things like your heart and how fast it's going. There was also another school, I mean, these are primary schools as well, that had a wristband that all these students were wearing. And the idea behind them, these schools had previously said, was that they could monitor children's safety. So if somebody unusual came onto campus, the school knew where these kids were, or if they wandered into a dangerous area. But the backlash online has been, this is effectively a tracking device. So I've seen tens of thousands of comments on Sina Weibo, which is China's platform like Facebook. And people have been saying that you wouldn't even treat a sex offender like this, that to monitor a kid at this extreme level. So, yeah, a lot of concern in China.
Could this feed into wider criticism of how the population is monitored in China in general?
Well, absolutely, yes. I mean, there's been this big conversation happening for some time about whether parents and teachers should be doing more, because it shouldn't be down to the technology. It should be a teacher and a parent educating a child and recognising if they have problems with their attention span.
Kerry Allen talking to my colleague Oliver Conway. Scientists in the United States have discovered that while you sleep, fluid in the brain and spinal cord can wash away harmful proteins, some of which have been linked to Alzheimer's. Researchers at the University of Rochester in New York State recorded the pulsating waves every 20 seconds. Riley Carlson reports.
Think of it like a washing machine. Waves of cerebral spinal fluid flow through your brain while you're sleeping, washing away waste products, including some toxins that scientists have linked to Alzheimer's disease. But while monitoring about a dozen sleeping people using MRI technology, they say they also noticed something else. before each wave of cerebral spinal fluid was electrical activity that scientists know to be what's called a slow wave. Now, the research shows it may have been triggering that wash cycle. Professor Dirk Jan Dijk is the director of the University of Surrey Sleep Research Center. He gave his take on the research.
How can you enhance those slow waves, the deep sleep? You could do this by pharmacological means, but you may also be able to do this by what has been referred to as sleep engineering, trying to drive these slow waves by acoustic stimuli, which would then lead to more slow waves and more clearance of waste products.
Now scientists can look further into links between the two and how a less restful sleep could mean fewer slow waves, leading to less cleaning of the toxins in our brains.
Riley Carlson. Some of the world's most iconic mountains are becoming more dangerous and riskier to climb due to the effects of climate change. That's the stark message from climbing experts and scientists who say warming in the Alps has thinned ice and snow cover, leading to more rock falls and landslides. In some places, routes have had to be abandoned and climbing sessions have had to be brought forward. Our World Service environment correspondent Navin Singh Kadka explains just how bad the problem has become.
The studies that we have seen and the observations by mountain guides and experts, what they say is there are many places now which have been affected, impacted. And we did hear anecdotal observations before, but now the fact that this umbrella organization of mountaineering, it's having its annual meeting in Cyprus and they are discussing this as a significant issue, it itself speaks for it. So it's a massive issue. And we've been hearing from mountain guides, from scientists, that things are changing. And if you want me to explain what's happening, basically, you know, it's that thinning of ice and snow that kind of kept the rocks together. So rock fall is the biggest issue now. Rock fall and also landslides. And then because of the melting, accelerated melting of glaciers, so you see crevasses widening, that means major challenge for mountaineers. So the term they use is permafrost. So permafrost is being impacted everywhere. But the thing is, if you had snow and ice working as some kind of cementing those rocks and they are going out, so the rock falls. And then also the fact that when you put on crampons, so for example, Sherpas in the Himalayas told me, when you're wearing crampons on rocks, unlike in snow or ice, so it's like, you know, high heels on marble. You can't walk properly. That is the issue. So there are practical issues they are facing now. So the broad picture that you know, so human society about this carbon emissions, how do you tackle with climate change? So can you stabilize that? That's the biggest, I mean, global question. But then locally, what these guys are saying is we will need to adapt to these changes. But the thing is, for that, they'll need to identify where is happening what. And for that, they're asking for research and development. And after that, they say they'll be able to train their guides.
Our World Service environment correspondent, Navin Singh Kadka. Most people know him best as the cool mathematician in Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park. But Jeff Goldblum, whose acting career has also seen him appear in The Fly, Independence Day and The Big Chill, is concentrating on making music right now. Last year, his debut jazz album shot to the top of the US and UK jazz charts. And on Friday, his follow-up, I Shouldn't Be Telling You This, was released. My colleague Carney Sharp caught up with him.
You know, there's a lot of improvisation in jazz, and I do some improvisation in my acting. There's something about me that's kind of loosey-goosey here and there. And the music on this album, I Shouldn't Be Telling You This, that's the name of the album, I Shouldn't Be Telling You This, is very spontaneous.
This is how we see this album, and we see you, offbeat,
yes.
Experimental,
uh-huh.
Improvisational.
Uh-huh.
Would you say, then, that this genre is very close to the character that is Jeff Goldblum?
Well, I don't know. I feel like I'm changing. You know, I'm a humbled student, and my life is even now in a kind of a growth spurt. I've got a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. But yeah, there's something about that music and harmonies in it. I like all kind of emotional things that it does and rhythmic things that it does. I just like it.
You're underplaying your talent here.
Me? Oh. I feel like I'm getting better. I play all the time. I'm serious about it. And even though I've got many other things on my plate besides the kids, I've got a movie part that I'm working on now, and I'm busy. But, you know, I wake up at 5:30 in the morning usually. I woke up very early this morning, even though I got in from L.A. yesterday, and I went there. They gave me a special room at the hotel where there's a piano. So I went through my whole workload this morning before we even started, and I work on it. And I tell you, I played better this morning than I've ever played. You know, if you do it every day for 50 years, it's something starts to happen.
You mentioned that you're a dad, and you said you spoke about your two sons.
Yeah.
And when I listen to Little Man, who are you singing it to? You, from the two of them, are you singing to both of them?
Yeah, I am singing to both of them. Or on some days, you know, I imagine one or another of them, you know, who have just had song goes, "Little man, you're crying.
You're crying.
I know why you're blue." And, you know, so there's usually a crisis of one kind or another. "Someone stole your kitty car away. Better go to sleep now, little man. You've had a busy day." I put him to bed every night, along with Emily, my wife, and I had sung that to them through the last couple of years. And when the band and I started to say, "Hey, what should we have on this album? Should I sing?" "Yeah, maybe you should sing." "Well, if you sang, what would you sing?" I said, "Hey, there's this song." They went, wait a minute, that's a good song. And I recorded it, but we played it to the kids the other day from the album, and they, I think they like it.
You have your acting career. Do they marry each other, or are you leaving one to transition into the other?
No, I haven't yet sacrificed anything from either for the other. And in fact, they overlap in the fun I have, you know. So far, it's working out good. I'm busy. I'm going to do that Jurassic World movie. We're going to film it around here next summer. I'm very excited about that. So yeah, I'm busy, but it's all kind of intermarrying. Yeah.
Connie Sharp speaking with Jeff Goldblum. There'll be another Global News podcast, of course, tomorrow. But let's finish this edition with my personal favourite, the magnificent Sharon Von Etten performing Jeff Goldblum and the Mildred Schnitzer Orchestra's version of the classic Let's Face the Music and Dance.
Let's face the music and dance.